a notice of 5 minutes or 1 minute.
I did, and I appreciate the warning, Your Honor. I look out for my metaphorical. May it please the Court, I'm Charles Rothfeld, representing the defendants in this case. The complaints allege a global and long-lasting conspiracy to raise the price of potash. It's our submission that the complaints should be dismissed for two reasons, because they are inconsistent with the standards stated by the Foreign Trade Antitrust Improvements Act, and because they cannot state a plausible claim under the standards for Sherman Act claims under Twombly. Fundamentally, it cannot be enough under the FTAIA for a plaintiff to allege foreign price increases and episodic foreign supply interruptions, which is all that the plaintiffs fundamentally allege here. It cannot be enough under.
I'm not sure what you mean by that, because the FTAIA is a statute designed to address, as the name suggests, foreign commerce, but it excludes import commerce. So I assume that for things like international price fixing conspiracies for lysine or international price fixing conspiracies for meth or other sorts of things, in which there are imports into the United States, that is to say, things that directly enter U.S. commerce. Why does the FTAIA have anything to do with that? It excludes those things.
Well, there is no doubt that this case involves foreign commerce. That there are the potash that's brought into the United States, which is the basis for the plaintiff's claims, come in from.
Correct. And another a synonym for articles brought into the United States is imports.
That is correct, but.
What's your understanding of import commerce, the term import commerce?
Well, there are two things in the FTIA that could give rise to a cause of action. Either this case could involve import commerce, and the word involve is crucial, or it could the foreign acts could have direct substantial reasons.
Wait, you lost me. I'm asking the first section, right, about involving import commerce. So what is your Is it your view that it's just not direct and substantial, or is it your view that this is not a case that involves import commerce?
It is our view that this does not involve import commerce.
Okay, so that means you must have a conception of import commerce.
We do. Well, we have a conception of what involving import commerce means. There is no question, again, that when...
I don't know what you can do with involving. Well, it's awfully broad.
Well, I think not, for two reasons. First of all, the meaning...
If import commerce means an imported commodity like potash, then it obviously involves import commerce. I thought maybe you had a conception of import commerce as not the mere importation of a product, but something maybe limited to the shippers or the people who arrange for the imports.
That's
not your position, fine, I'm just...
No, that is not our contention. Our contention is, as the
so this is import commerce, but you think that the case doesn't involve it?
It does not involve import commerce in the way that term is used in the FTA.
Which term? Involving or import commerce?
The
term involving actually isn't there. It says sections 1 to 7 of this title, meaning Title 15 in the Sherman Act, shall not apply to conduct involving trade or commerce with foreign nations. That's where it is. And then insert in there is this parenthetical, other than import trade or import commerce.
But
so the purpose of this statute was to make sure the United States didn't butt into other people's affairs. That meant export commerce, goods going out to other countries, and it meant all sorts of transactions that took place outside the United States that might have had an effect in the U.S., of which there are many, of course. And the United States had a very bad record of investigations that were entitled things like In Re World Arrangements, which was the oil investigation in the 1950s. So this statute was passed to assure the rest of the world we're not going to do that. But imports, if you take some potash from Canada and you send it into the United States, you're choosing to participate.
If I may, there is no question that people who bring potash into the United States are participating in the U.S. market. But the question is, what is the scope of the FTA as it relates to these transactions? The allegations here...
The FTA excludes this, though.
But if I may, the allegations here are related to overseas setting of prices overseas, production overseas. There's no...
I'm talking about the merits. Yes, those are the allegations. And the allegations include the fact that a benchmark price was derived from the China, India, and Brazil transactions, which was then used to set the price for these transactions in the U.S. But that's a merits question, as I see it. You know, is there, you know, have you shown the kind of price fixing that's illegal?
Well, that will go to whether there's a direct effect, which is a separate question. But
it also goes to whether you've shown that there is price fixing. Price fixing can certainly be done by means of creating a benchmark price. All sorts of benchmark prices in the world. Brent oil is a benchmark price. It's used for all sorts of transactions.
Well, if I can give you two answers or two separate questions here. First, on the question of benchmark prices, and I would like to get back to the involved.
Before you get to that, I don't understand. I want to understand your statutory argument. As I read, you know, the statute shall not apply to conduct involving trade or commerce other than import trade or commerce. So if it involves import trade or commerce, then the statute doesn't apply, and we just have the Sherman Act. Right?
That is correct. Okay. If it involves
now,
import
if
trade
this
or commerce.
Is import commerce, wouldn't that have
But
to mean that somehow the case didn't involve this import.
If I may, Your Honor.
Otherwise, you don't get to the second part, the direct, substantial, and foreseeable.
That is correct. But what we think that Congress had in mind when it said it involves import commerce in this context is that the Anti-Competitive Act, which is challenged, is what must involve the import commerce.
You're engrafting an epigram idea into this, which I think doesn't fit well, because, of course, we remember the facts of the epigram were foreign consumers complaining about injury in foreign markets, and it happened to be an industry that also in the U.S., and the Supreme Court says quite reasonably that's not within the scope of our statute. The court analyzes the FTAIA, says until you show something where the actual offense is affecting the U.S. market, you haven't crossed the threshold. But here, there's an allegation, which may or may not be proven, and I have no idea if they'll prove it, that there's price fixing that's setting the price of these products that are sent to the U.S., not a different product, these products.
But I think that the allegation, and let me take a step back to Judge Posner's question, what exactly does involving mean in this context? It's involving cannot mean that any time that an importer brings products into the United States, when there is no agreement as to fixed prices as to those products once they get here,
sure, but look, it says shall not apply to conduct involving trade or product. So suppose the conduct is price fixing. Okay. Then if there's price fixing and it involves import commerce, then the Sherman Act is fully applicable, right?
If there's price fixing relating to the products which are brought into the United States, the allegations.
Well, clearly the allegation.
Yeah. The parenthetical says other than import trade or import commerce. Your supplemental brief, particularly, was quite explicit in saying you read that to mean other than import trade or import commerce in which the price fixing occurs, that is, in which the illegal behavior occurs. But that's just an extra set of words that's not in that statute. Congress might have drafted that statute, but I don't understand how you get from the actual statute to that conclusion.
Well, I think that's the reading that's given the statute by other courts and by the Department of Justice, and I think that the reason that they have given it that reading is because if it is interpreted more broadly, the involving commerce exception, this narrow parenthetical, swallows the direct effects exception because
no,
essentially
it just makes Section 6A, the FTAIA, unpronounceable acronym, just makes Section 6A go poof. You now have the Sherman Act, and there's a fairly elaborate jurisprudence under the Sherman Act about whether the United States has prescriptive jurisdiction over foreign conduct. It just means you're back in that older jurisprudence. Now, what's wrong with that?
Right. You're back to Hartford Fire, in a sense, where the court pulls forward the old Alcoa test and creates a standard for when effects are sufficient, just as we have for interstate commerce cases that talk about what kind of an effect on interstate commerce is enough. We don't worry about all the rest of this stuff.
Well, I'll say two things about that. We will embrace the Hartford and the Alcoa standard. We think we would prevail under that for the same reasons that we prevail under the FTAA. But I don't think that that's what Congress was up to. I think Congress said pretty clearly when it drafted the statute that it meant to sort of codify and clarify the pre-existing standard. And so
yeah, well, it doesn't say that either. And as Judge Friendly said long ago in a securities case rather than an antitrust case, we have to be particularly sure of our ground before we would say that Congress meant something other than what it said.
Well,
what it says in that parenthetical is just import trade or import commerce.
Well, I'll take one more run at this. It says involving import trade or import commerce. If one unpacks,
no, it does not. You're misquoting the statute. The statute says conduct involving trade or commerce, paren, other than import trade or import commerce. Right? We've got to get the statute what it actually says rather than reword it in any fashion.
I agree with that, Your Honor, but I think that the parenthetical involving trade or commerce, other than import trade or import commerce, is a condition upon conduct involving it, and it immediately follows. I mean, there is no doubt, as everyone has universally recognized, this is an inartfully worded statute.
I think I understand your position. If the plaintiffs can only prove price fixing directly affecting the Brazil and the Chinese transactions, you guys are out from under U.S. jurisdiction. How would your theory apply to our attempt of foreign producers who are alleged simply to agree to restrict supply? The flip side of the agreement of price.
Restrict the supply to foreign purchasers or?
Restricting global production, which has a predictable, obvious effect on price, on those imports.
I can certainly imagine that if the allegation were, and it is not in this case, if the allegation were that there were a global production quota that was cutting.
There are allegations of agreements to restrict global supply.
Well, there are allegations to, and I think it's helpful to look specifically at what the allegations are.
Let's first focus on the statutory issue. Okay. How would the statute apply to what you're hypothesizing, a global cartel with quotas on production?
The way we would look at it is that if, in fact, there were 50% cut in supply across the board, which created global scarcity as to some product, that would not, as we read the term involving import commerce, it would not involve import commerce. It would have a direct foreseeable.
That's kind of fantastic. Why would Congress want to exempt import commerce from antitrust law?
But it does not, because it.
Well, that's Judge Easterbrook's point.
Then your answer to Judge Hamilton's question can't possibly be what this thing means. I could understand an argument that you're outside the federal antitrust laws if you set, say, a global quota. We won't produce more than a billion tons of potash anywhere in the world, right, for the year. And that's necessarily going to drive up the world price. What the Sherman Act then means, as I understand it, is, and it is a felony for you to sell any of that potash in the United States. If you want to sell in the United States, you have to get rid of the quota on output, because that's, in U.S. law, a violation of U.S. law. You want to play in the U.S. market? You've got to live by U.S. law. Now, that's a perfectly straightforward rule. I can imagine all sorts of complications if the foreign producers who have set an output limit never sell in the U.S., and the person who buys it abroad engages in arbitrage and sells into the U.S. market. Then we got real complexities.
If the conspirators
are selling in the U.S., I don't see how one can say it's outside U.S. law just because it's a global quota.
No, my answer, I'm afraid, was cut off. I don't say it is outside U.S. law at all. I'm saying that there are two different ways one can get at it. One can get at it if it involves import commerce in our sense, that if the anti-competitive conduct is actually a part of that transaction. That's one way to get it. If it doesn't satisfy that, then one goes to the second prong of the test, which is there
but
a direct, immediate.
Why would Congress want to exempt import?
I think that Congress, if there were a direct, Congress was concerned with taking the Alcoa standard and had been imperfectly
no,
applied.
No, I understand the concern with the antitrust laws reaching out to transactions between foreigners. But if the transaction is with the United States, it's part of import commerce, and some conduct abroad is raising the price or reducing the supply, why would Congress want to exempt that?
But it did not, if the effect were a direct effect on the United States.
What's this direct effect? Suppose that, in fact, you have potash. Suppose it's all imported. We're very dependent on it. And as a result of monopolistic behavior abroad, the price zooms in the United States. Now, why would Congress want to exempt that kind of behavior?
It would not.
Like the kind of behavior involved in this case. Why would they want
that, to exempt that? It would not if it's as you describe it. If there were monopolist behavior.
Well, no, that's this case.
But that's this case.
You seem to think that there needs to be a memo saying, and we're really glad since the United States is a big customer that it's going to have to pay these enhanced prices along with everybody else. But the word direct doesn't appear until you get past this import exclusion. The word direct, or the direct substantially and reasonably foreseeable effects test applies to Judge Easterbrook's arbitrage hypothetical, for example.
But if we're looking at the allegations here are principally that prices were raised in overseas markets and that those overseas price increases filtered through the global marketplace and had some effect ultimately in the United States.
Well, I think it had a pretty dramatic effect on the price of potash in the United States.
Well,
I don't think this is a speculative.
Well, the allegation.
Look, if you have a globally traded commodity and you raise price in one place, you have to reduce the supply. And when you reduce the supply, you have price effects all over the world.
Don't say it can be.
Give me an example where it's not true. It has to be true.
If prices are raised in China and that diminishes demand in China, it could be that there is an additional.
No, the price has to increase in the United States, because if it doesn't increase in the United States, people will import the potash into the United States, and then they'll reship it to China.
But I will give you two answers to that, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. What's your answer? Is that wrong? Am I wrong? That doesn't happen. You ever heard of arbitrage? You know what that word means?
It certainly can happen, depending on
Has to happen.
Well, if I...
How's it not going to happen, right?
It doesn't happen, Mr. Rothfeld. Intelligent adults are leaving money sitting on the table. And usually, in antitrust litigation of all things, we don't accuse businessmen of being insufficiently attentive to profit opportunities.
And that is not the basis for our argument here. But I will return to what Congress was up to in the FTAA. If you look at what...
Well, now you tell us how it is that prices... I mean, China, of course, is a very huge market for potash. So prices rise there, right? So if prices rise there, it must be, isn't it, that the supply in China has diminished?
It could. The particular allegations... The particular allegations in this complaint is that supply was withheld from China to drive up prices
in China.
Right.
Okay. Now, what happens to the supply that's withheld?
The complaint doesn't say. It could be that it's made available.
Well, is it coming to the United States?
As I say, the complaint does not say.
Is it coming to the United States? I mean, the question is whether there's any logic to your position or whether it just doesn't make the slightest bit of sense.
Well, as
we have them reducing supply. Now, if they reduce it worldwide, then the price of potash will rise everywhere where potash is bought. But if, on the other hand, maybe they say, okay, United States, love the United States, don't want to get in trouble with antitrust, so we're not going to raise price to the United States. But then you have the problem that people buying potash cheap in the United States will reship to China. Now, is there something wrong with that logic?
There's nothing wrong with that logic, but the problem I think that plaintiffs confront here is when Congress wrote the statute, the FTAA, it was had in mind observations like Judge Hand's observation in the Alcoa case, that any reduction in supply, as he said expressly for the court in Alcoa, in South America or Europe will have repercussions in the United States. But it cannot be that simply because as the effects work their way through the global marketplace, that is sufficient to support prescriptive jurisdiction in the United States.
Wait a minute. I want to go back to what was happening to potash. Paragraph 87 of the direct purchaser specifically alleges that defendants implemented their conspiracy at least in part through coordinated restrictions in potash output. So in other words, it's not that they decided not to sell to the Chinese and send all the potash to the United States. It was global restrictions in output, which the complaint then further alleges, led to very dramatic increases in price. Now, they do also make this benchmarking point. Now, if one were hypothetically talking about entirely external transactions, and I don't think we are under these allegations, but there you, of course, as we've all agreed, would move to the direct, substantial, reasonably foreseeable effects test that Congress wrote into that statute. Some courts have adopted it, other courts have taken a much more free-wheeling approach to things, and so Congress is certainly trying to rein that in. But I'm not really sure in this case.
Well, I think it would be helpful at this point actually to turn to what the complaint says specifically. It is true that in paragraph 87 of the direct purchaser's complaint, there is a very general and conclusory allegation about coordinated restrictions. When one looks at the actual particular allegations as to what the defendants did in the marketplace, and we have a
is there a real specific allegation about October of 2007, where there's a sinkhole issue and the decision not to restrict output at that point?
There is an allegation there. That
very specific, isn't it?
It's specific. As we deal with that, I think thoroughly in our reply brief, what was happening there is there was a 12-day interruption in supply in which not all of the defendants, some but not all of the defendants, said that they were going to withhold additional new sales until they saw whether or not the sinkhole was actually real. And when it was apparent that it wasn't, then the supply restriction was abandoned. So it was a sort of temporary, on the face of the complaint, it appeared to be a temporary.
It's a little bit of your explanation strikes me as rather implausible, especially since it does rely on the notion that ex ante, nobody really knew how long this sinkhole problem was going to last, and these people are all behaving in a rather clubby way as opposed to seeing a business opportunity and moving for it.
Well,
it's not like an airplane, which requires a long lead time to construct. It's just it's a thing that's mined. Sold as it comes out of the mine.
Well, two observations about that. First of all, the Mosaic Company, which is the second largest potash producer in the world, did not suspend its sales. So, it's a peculiar conspiracy in which the second largest participant does not join in. But I don't think well, I the second answer is that I don't think there's anything at all peculiar in which it's unclear what the long-term ramifications of this are going to be, and that will clarify itself relatively soon.
Is there any difference between this case and our high fructose sugar case? Very similar case. You know, you have a commodity, so it's easy to fix prices, and you have an oligopoly. Here it's really a duopoly. You've got two cartels, and they talk to each other. They have communications. Do you need more? For an antitrust case?
I think you do in a case like this. And maybe I should turn to the Twombly question. But this case, I think, is quite different from what was going on in Fructose. I mean, in Fructose, I mean, the court detailed these direct evidence, if believed, that would establish.
Pretty thin, actually, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, but it was substantially
thin.
More.
I mean, there's a little more than just the tacit coordination. A little more, we said, was enough. There's a lot of communication here. And you know, this is a duopoly, really. It's a duopoly with a commodity. It's very easy to coordinate pricing without a great deal of communication.
Well, if one looks at the specific allegations as to both price and supply, there's nothing like in Fructose or in other cases, in the text messaging case, in which there is simultaneous.
No, it's not the strongest cartel case in history. That's true.
But I would go beyond that. This is, I think, classic seriatim, follow the leader, pricing and supply conduct.
Let me ask you, Mr. Rothfeld, the complaint, the direct buyer's complaint, paragraphs 93 and 108, both talk about suppliers applauding one another. This pretty general statement in paragraph 93. 108 is quite specific, attributing it to one particular executive, complimenting the Bell Region defendants on their, quote, tremendous discipline in terms of managing supply and market. What do you think he's talking about?
Well,
Mr. Rothfeld, before you answer, you have 5 minutes left.
I appreciate that. If I may, I'll answer this question and reserve the balance of my time.
Answer, Judge Hamilton.
Yeah, I will. I think that there are sort of two problems with reliance on that. First of all, these are small snippets of statements. It's not clear at all what the context is, what the statement is about, and as the Supreme Court. No, I understand. As the Supreme Court said in Twombly, as to very, very similar statements. It is impossible to sort of read this without the context and really understand what's being said. The other thing I would say about it is that I took this to be, there are a number of statements recited. They're all by a single executive of a Russian company, which is a participant in one of the BPC, a joint marketing operation. And I took him to be referring to the activities of the Russian and Belarusian participants in the joint marketing operation, which is partly legitimate conduct. And so I don't think that there really is, in context, anything at all suspicious about those statements. And if I may, Your Honor, I'll reserve the balance.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This is a product restraint cartel which is closely connected to the United States. And the reality of the situation is that this cartel could not have operated with production restraints without affecting its second largest customer in the world. We are talking about United States plaintiffs, all of whom are in the agriculture business in the United States, United States defendants, including Mosaic, which is a U.S. incorporated company, and subsidiaries of several of the defendants.
What percentage of the potash purchased in the United States do imports account for?
86%, as alleged in the complaint, I think, in 2008, but there are statistics on the U.S. Geological Survey which show is as high as 95 or 96% in certain periods of time as well. So, and almost 50% of that comes from Canada.
And there's no indication that there's excess capacity in the United States?
No, because it's got the smallest deposits probably of anybody. The biggest deposits are in Canada and in Canada, primarily, and in Russia, Belarus. That's why we have these particular entities involved. The other thing I would point out is that the reason this is a particularly U.S. cartel is not only because the U.S. is the second largest, but these same mines provide the supply to the entire world. When production is cut, it's cut to everybody.
That poses an interesting question that I alluded to in asking Mr. Rothfeld. Suppose none of the defendants sells an ounce of potash in the United States. They dig it out of the ground outside the United States, and they sell it to customers at the mine door, right? And their customers sell it where they will, but of course the price at which they sell it where they will depends on output. So a cutback in output will drive up the price in the United States. Do you think that it would be possible to sue in the United States for violating the Sherman Act the people who cut back output but never sold an ounce of potash in the U.S.?
I don't think you probably could, Your Honor. I think that you're probably right with that hypothetical, that that would present a problem. But we have people, companies here, who are selling millions of tons directly into the United States.
I understand that. But I'm worried about this because, of course, if we rule in your favor in this case, I expect that that will be the next thing that happens. They will stop selling directly to the United States. They will sell to middlemen. And the potash will find its way to the United States at the world price. Part of the question, you know, putting aside whether your clients get treble damages between here and there, part of my question is, does that do any good for U.S. consumers? Because it then looks like we're back in the same bucket.
Well, they have tried to do it in a certain sense by developing Canpotex, which is the company that only sells outside the United States, but, you know, they also have companies that sell within the United States. And I think that
what Judge Easterbrook has described is very much the business model that the De Beers company has used from time out of mind for diamonds. And at least the official position of the United States has been that this takes you to the FTAIA test. You have to show that there's a direct substantial reason to foresee. But the thing that has doomed most of the efforts to reach De Beers has been personal jurisdiction.
And we don't have that problem here. We have service on all these defendants, and they're here, and they've submitted to the court, and they've answered the complaint. So I don't know that notice is an issue has been,
Well, it's obviously not an issue directly in this case. I'm just asking whether in the long run, establishing a rule that will lead other firms to adopt the De Beers model is going to help U.S. consumers very much at all.
One thing I would say is if you accept...
Wouldn't that be an example where the effect was indirect?
If there was the De Beers example? Well, it depends if they're bringing it into the United States themselves. If they're not bringing it in at all into the United States, then I would say then there is potentially
indirect.
Of course,
the problem there is it depends how broadly you're going to interpret the first section about involving...
Right.
Well, and I was.
But it also depends on whether they slip up, as De Beers did when it struck an agreement with General Electric about industrial diamonds and got clobbered.
Right. But involves is a word I think somebody already used the word. It's been engrafted onto import commerce. It really doesn't appear in the parenthetical. It appears above. It talks about export commerce. I think the cases are very clear that the FTAIA was not intended ever to include import commerce. So,
is your position that all this stuff about whether we should use the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act understanding of the word direct or whether we should use proximate cause is really not your problem because you can anyway under just the straightforward import?
Yes, Your Honor. But if you do get there, if you got there and wanted to measure it against that, then the whole idea that a production restraint in a global market with the U.S. as the second leading customer is not going to have a direct effect in the United States, where there's 600% increase in prices, which is a radical difference from what was happening before 2003 and is not explained by anybody, including the defendants, I would say that we meet that test as well.
There have been tremendous commodity price increases during this period.
There have been. And but those commodity price increases, we have some allegations in there, including fuel, have not gone up anywhere near 600%. And this is a 600% rise from 2003 through 2008, when before, you see the chart at paragraph 113 of the complaint, it looks basically flat before that. We also have a radical change here, too, because you have the Russians coming into the market who before were flooding the market at every chance with potash. Every piece of market share that they could get, they tried to get. And yet, in this particular situation, the sinkhole being one example, but there being other examples, the Russians are not doing that. And they're being complimented not just by other Russians, but by the Canadians for their discipline in not putting potash into the market. This is very much the statements that have been made in this case. There are multiple statements. I mean, we are not in the room where all these things are being discussed, nor could we be. These statements about discipline and setting the rules of the game are very much like in text messaging. The term coopetition is used instead of competition. I think we have multiple examples where the things that are coming out of the mouths of the very people who are doing this are acknowledging that discipline is what's required in this market. And I think that's, you rarely see that in a complaint like this. Yes, we do have cases. I'm involved in some of them where we had meetings and we had the notes of the meetings and an amnesty applicant. But this shouldn't be measured against that. We don't have an investigation at this point. And we have alleged facts that I think would get far beyond any line in an antitrust complaint subject with no criminal investigation in parallel with the case. So in terms of Twombly, I think we get there. I don't think you ever get to the direct effects test. And I think that it would be implausible and unrealistic the way the world works to not have this particular cartel affect the United States in a very substantial way under whatever test the court would decide to apply. I will say, if the court were to decide to set a different standard and not go with the clear face of the FTAIA and the word involved. And
it's what, not very clear, I must say.
It is not. It is a creature of congressional negotiation and a number of statutes, Your Honor, like the PSLRA and CAFA, where they all make it very complicated. And it wasn't...
It's a creature of midnight drafting. It's engrafted on the Export Trading Company Act at the last second.
Right. And the parenthetical was put in pretty much at the last minute, too, because somebody raised the question, what about import commerce? Import commerce has always been subject to the Sherman Act. I mean, that's Alcoa and Hartford and pre-FTAIA. And you know, that does go to a question as well that the court may be thinking about, which is United Phosphorus, which is if you get to that point where we're talking about the merits, and we are, because we're applying the Sherman Act to a basically a garden variety commodity product restraint case, then we're really talking about the merits as opposed to something that's jurisdictional. And I don't know that the court is looking at that particular issue, but the first question last time we had a hearing was, should we reconsider United Phosphorus? I answered yes then, and I would give the same answer now in light of Arbaugh and Morrison.
Well, I would just note that whatever it is we're talking about, claims or jurisdiction or what have you, this is a statute about the applicability, in fact, of both the Sherman Act and the FTC Act. So it applies to government actions, whether they be prosecutions or Federal Trade Commission unfair competition proceedings, as well as private actions for double damages.
And as you know, and as has been quoted in some of the cases, the government is prosecuting at any given time 50 international cartel cases, and this would throw obstacles in their way if the defendant's interpretation of the FTAI were accepted. You know, the antitrust enforcement guidelines from 1995 have been submitted by the defendants, but those guidelines say on import commerce, it's presumed that it's a direct effect. I mean, it tracks the old Hartford-Alcoa line of thinking and not something that was created by virtue of the midnight negotiations at Congress. If the court were going to either refine the standard or say a different standard, which I don't think the court needs to do, then we would, of course, ask for leave to amend, which I don't think we need to do. But if the standard was changed, we haven't had an opportunity to amend. We don't think we need to, but I would end on just pointing out that if you do change the standard, Judge Castillo has never had an opportunity to let us amend on the merits. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Simon. Mr. Rothfeld. Three minutes and 45 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's two points relating to the FTAIA. First, I think it is important not to lose sight of what Congress was up to. Congress was very concerned in drafting the statute with considerations of comity. As the Supreme Court has told us in Embergram, as this Court said in United Phosphorus, it was important to Congress, both as a general matter in all of its statutes and in the FTAI in particular.
I think even if the first section or the prefatory sentence were read very narrowly, I don't see how you get away from direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable. It's direct, it's substantial, and it's entirely foreseeable.
Well, I
have a drastic reduction in supply in a commodity traded worldwide. It's going to hit the United States.
Well, the allegation is not of a drastic reduction in supply. The allegation, when one actually looks at it, is of episodic.
You can't divorce, with exceptions that are not applicable, you can't divorce a higher price from a reduction in supply. You raise the price. Look, what happens? You raise the price. Some people won't pay the higher price, right? And that means there's now too much product in the market. So whether you start by reducing output or you start by raising price, you're going to have less output.
Well, it depends.
Everyone's going to be making stuff that nobody buys.
But, it can't be the case that whenever there is any reduction in supply anywhere in the world,
No, that's why I said direct, substantial, and reasonable. If there's a very small reduction in supply, very small increase in price, the effects will not be substantial. They may not even be foreseeable.
And as I said at the outset, if
you have a 600% price increase, that's substantial.
That the price increase was substantial if it were a consequence of this.
The price increase was a consequence of?
There was as has been said by Judge Easterbrook, there was increase in commodity prices overall, and there in particular there was as the complaint itself alleges, there was a rally in agriculture in 2008 at the time of the largest
crisis. There's a big increase in demand.
There is a big increase in demand.
Okay, that's one theory, right? But another theory is that it was a deliberate increase in price, reduction in supply, right? That's the other theory.
But the theory is not a statutory. The theory is divorced.
If their allegations are correct, isn't it true that there's a direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable?
The answer to that is no, because the allegations that are actually made in the complaint does not allege the kind of dramatic reduction in supply which is suggested by the questioning.
You don't necessarily need a dramatic reduction in supply to have a dramatic increase in price. Depends on the elasticity.
But the allegations, even as to the episodic reductions in supply that are alleged, the conspiracy is alleged to have lasted from July of 2003 to the filing of the complaint. There were supply restrictions that are alleged as to a couple of the defendants, not as to all of them, at 2 years during the course of this conspiracy, at the end of 2005, beginning 2006, and at 2008. The allegation in 2008 involved only a small set of the defendants. And so this is not a case in which one can say that there was a kind of dramatic reduction in supply that one would expect to have this.
We did have a 600% price increase. How could we decide direct, substantial, foreseeable as a matter of law? What are those evidence-driven?
Not necessarily. I think that what direct means is a legal question. And as other courts have said.
Mr. Rothfeld, your time has now expired, but as I've told other counsel, you can of course continue to answer any questions from the bench.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is the application necessarily specific facts?
Well, we have to measure what the word direct means against what's alleged in the complaint here. Direct means, we think, as a matter of dictionary definition, interpretation
by
the courts.
They read a dictionary when they were drafting us?
Well, I think that they may have read
Which dictionary did they look at?
They may have read the Supreme Court's decision in the Weltover case, which was decided under another acronym, the FSIA, a couple of years before this statute was enacted, in which the court interpreted this very word direct and said it means immediate. So I think, to answer Judge Hamilton, that one can look at what's alleged here and say, is the allegation that there were episodic price supply reductions in Belarus, Does that have a direct effect and in the immediate sense of immediacy and inevitability in the United States? And I think that one can answer that as a matter of law on the pleadings that are stated here. There are no further questions.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.